Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today I'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a heartbreaking image of a young Salvadoran father face down in the Rio Grande with his two-year-old dead daughter clinging to him, which has shocked many in this country and around the world, prompting an expression of sorrow from the Pope while Trump blamed the Democrats. Diane Winston, who holds a night chair in media and religion at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, joins us to discuss whether Trump's base, the religious right, will be moved from their focus of only caring for the unborn to start caring for living children and strangers, as the Bible instructs in the parable of the Good Samaritan, since we as Americans are all responsible for the children in our custody at the border. Already cracks appear in the evangelical world, with theologian Russell Moore calling for those created in the image of God to be treated with dignity and compassion. This prompted a bizarre rebuke from the recent subject of a scandal himself, Jerry Falwell Jr., involving his wife and a pool boy, with Falwell attacking Moore for not having made a payroll, resulting in a Twitter storm of protest on social media, with one user asking, "Did Jesus ever make a payroll?" With the House and Senate having passed bills to deal with the humanitarian crisis at the border, we will assess whether the bills can be reconciled and if the president will veto an aid package for the children that doesn't have money for his war. Then we will speak with the feminist author and blogger Amanda Marcotte, who is a politics writer for Salon, where her latest articles are, "Trump fans think he's a macho he-man, he's really a moral weakling who preys on women and kids," and "Trump accused of rape, major media yawns. Why was E. Jean Carroll's story not front page news?" She joins us to discuss the contrast between how the media piled on when a state legislator accused Joe Biden of touching her shoulders and kissing the back of her head, and accusations of rape by Trump's former wife, Ivana, which are now buttressed by a veteran journalist, E. Jean Carroll. Then finally, just ahead of tonight's first Democratic presidential debate, we will speak with Alan Schroeder, Professor Emeritus in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University and author of Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk TV, and Celebrity-in-Chief, How Show Business Took Over the White House. He joins us to discuss how quickly the field of 20 can be winnowed to the point where there will be an opportunity for substantive debates between fewer candidates instead of a five-minute shot at getting recognized. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now, Diane Winston, who holds the night chair in media and religion at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, and she's the former publisher of Religion Dispatches. Welcome to Background Briefing, Diane Winston.
Hi, Ian. Good to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And do you think that this appalling picture that's on the front pages of many newspapers around the world of a young Salvadoran father and his two-year-old daughter face down in the Rio Grande, having washed ashore after drowning, trying to cross into the United States after having spent about a month in Mexico trying to get asylum in the United States. It's got the Pope outraged. It's got all kinds of people outraged, including a number of Republicans. And, of course, it's happening at a time when both the House and Senate have passed $4.6 billion bills to address the issue of the terrible conditions that children being held at on the border. So is this going to move the needle with the religious right in terms of their support for Donald Trump?
This shocking photo ought to move the needle for anyone with a heart. However, I am not sure if it will do much to change the minds of Trump supporters on the religious right. One of their main concerns is abortion, and the killing of live children is less important than what they see as the murder of the unborn. That's a horrible and harsh thing to say, but I believe it's true, and you can see it in the way they approach so many other issues that could help the lives of poor children, migrant children, refugee children, and the total lack of concern. There may be churches whose pastors are supporters of the religious right, where members look at this photo and may think to themselves, what can I do, or what should I be doing, or maybe this government isn't right. But I don't think it's going to be a groundswell. I think it may be individuals who have a change of heart, and I just don't imagine that there's going to be a mass exodus away from Trump.
Well, already, because of the reports from the lawyers who are able to visit these children in this, particularly in this Border Patrol detention facility in Clint, Texas, the outrage over the conditions under which these children were held was such that local church groups were bringing diapers and food and toothbrushes to these kids. And of course, the Border Patrol turned them away. So there's been obviously a compassionate response from the religious community. And I imagine down in Texas, they're likely to be more conservative in terms of not necessarily the religious right, but at least somewhere in the evangelical fold. But already a spat has broken out between the theologian Russell Moore, the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, and Jerry Falwell Jr. of Liberty University, who inherited that from his father, Jerry Falwell. Russell Moore tweeted out, "The reports of the conditions for migrant children at the border should shock all of our consciences. Those created in the image of God should be treated with dignity and compassion, especially those seeking refuge from violence back home. We can do better than this." And then Jerry Falwell then replies to him, "Who are you, Dr. Moore? Have you ever made a payroll? Have you ever built an organization of any type from scratch? What gives you the authority to speak on any issues? I'm being serious. You're nothing but an employee, a bureaucrat." Now, what is building organizations and meeting payrolls got to do with what's going on the border with fathers and the two-year-olds drowning? I mean, haven't people like Falwell ever heard of the Good Samaritan parable? These children are in our custody. We, as a country and as a people, in the terms of our collective conscience, should be behaving in a Christian way towards travelers, towards those in our custody. I am absolutely astounded by the bizarre remark from Falwell. What do you make of it?
I saw the exchange on Twitter, and Falwell got a lot of pushback. He didn't get a lot of support for that, and a lot of conservatives called him out for what he said. Falwell is sort of at times sui generis, and I wouldn't look to him as the voice of all evangelicals. And I want to say, all evangelicals are not members of the religious right, so it doesn't surprise me that churchgoers in Texas, who may be, you know, mainline Methodists or Episcopalians or even, you know, Catholics, may have gone to the border to help, because I think they are aware of the biblical commandment to help the stranger, to welcome the stranger. I think it's a minority of churchgoers who are so dead stuck on the religious right that their hearts would not be touched by that. But it's one thing to have your heart touched by that and to want to offer compassion, and another thing to want to get rid of Trump or get rid of his policy. I think you can hold both ideas at the same time. You want to help these people, but you still don't believe they should be coming here.
And again, I'm speaking with Diane Winston, who holds the Knight Chair in Media and Religion at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, and she's the former publisher of Religion Dispatches. Well, of course, Jerry Falwell Jr. was and his wife were the subject of a lengthy article recently in the New York Times. Apparently, there were some racy photographs involving his wife and a pool boy down in Florida who the Falwells had invested or loaned $4.7 million to, and Michael Cohen, Trump's lawyer, because of Trump's friendship with Jerry Falwell Jr., had to disappear these photographs from what we understand. So that was just, I mean, it's extraordinary. You cannot make, this stuff up. This takes you back to Jimmy Swaggart days. But for the strangest reason, yesterday in the White House at the Faith and Freedom Coalition conference, President Trump thanked Jerry Falwell Jr., who was there in the audience, saying, "Jerry is a friend of mine." And then he smiled and paused a bit and said, "I could tell you stories." Isn't that amazing? Well, the Trump Lord works in mysterious ways. What can I say?
Yeah. Trump is just playing the religious right, and Jerry Falwell is a willing participant in it. And whether it's a lust for power or for influence or there's some financial thing going on, I don't know. But I think even his own father would be a little surprised by the things that he's got into these days.
You mean like building a shooting range at the campus of Liberty University so that students can fire assault rifles?
Or the whole financial issues that were going on that Michael Cohen had to take care of. And if it's true that there are pictures, I think that Jerry Falwell Sr., well, I didn't agree with many of the things he preached. I think he had a healthy respect for integrity and for staying on the right side of the law.
So back to the main question, Diane Winston, of whether or not this shocking picture that has upset people all around the world, including the Pope and many religious leaders in this country and around the world, and a lot of our political leaders, both Democrats and Republicans, and it happens at coincides with a very important bill that the House passed yesterday to fund these, dare I say, concentration camps, these detention facilities where children are being kept in terrible conditions. And it's $4.5 billion in the House bill, $4.6 billion in the Senate bill. And surprising to me, frankly, the Senate bill has very few restrictions. And so Trump's not getting money for ICE and for his wall from either the House or the Senate. So it's up to him. It'll go to his desk. They're about to take a recess, the lawmakers. So do you expect a veto from Trump? He's warned that if he doesn't get his wall and money for ICE, he's going to veto it. But at the same time, he did say that he would hold off on mass deportations until the Congress dealt with the issue of the border problems writ large, but I think he obviously has a priority on the wall as opposed to dealing with these young kids in a humane way.
Yes, I would expect Trump is still going to hold out for what he wants. He's already said that, I believe, Obama, you know, was less compassionate than he is as regards to immigrants, which was not true. And, you know, this photo is graphic, but this is not the first child who's died. I think four or five children have, you know, died in the last week. He's not thinking about the humanitarian optics or even the humanitarian problems of this. He's thinking about getting that wall. And I don't believe his mind is going to be changed by this, especially not when supporters like Jerry Falwell, who gives him a certain Christian imprimatur, agree with him. He hears who he wants to hear, and even if, you know, a million church people descended on the White House, I'm not sure it would make a difference to him. He does not seem to have a heart for people who are suffering and or people who are different than him, or people who need help. I mean, it's ironic given how he can stand up and say, I'm for you, American people, I'm for you, people who aren't heard, who don't have a voice, and then turn his back on this kind of misery, but that's President Trump for you.
Well, there's also this character, Stephen Miller, who's a protege of Jeff Sessions, and together they started this project that Trump has seized on to demagogue the border and simply make life so miserable for immigrants fleeing north. Just simple cruelty in order to deter a flow of immigration. That's their strategy. And Miller, of course, apparently is behind this guy that just quit, who is going to be replaced at ICE by a hardliner. So that's what's happening on the ground, and that's who are running, basically running this policy. It's this character from Santa Monica High, who's sort of the, you know, the Rasputin of the Trump administration. So, I mean, you have to blame the president because he's taking this guy's advice, but essentially, this is a situation that Trump does not want to solve because it's more important to him and the Republicans to demagogue this issue, isn't it? They want to basically send out the subtext that we care about, read by the white Americans, and the Democrats only care about these undocumented people who aren't even Americans, and brown and black people, but not you people. Isn't that the subtext?
There's a racist subtext to this, which is very true. On the other hand, something you said earlier, Ian, really is important. And that is, if there was a voice to rally religious people in the country around this issue, around the issue of helping these migrants or these refugees, that might make a difference. I do think that theoretically this is an issue which cuts across religious traditions, religious groups. It even cuts across evangelicals and moderates and progressives, because anyone who takes the Bible seriously knows, as you said earlier, that one of the injunctions is to help the stranger and to be compassionate. That's a lot of what Jesus was saying up there on the Sermon on the Mount. And I would imagine if a religious figure could organize around this, there could be a large groundswell of support for change. Whether or not that would do anything is another question, but I would love to hear people speaking out and getting behind this issue in a way that hasn't happened in the religious community. And yes, I think Stephen Miller may be the brains behind this, but Trump is the face, and he's the person who I hold responsible, even more than Miller, because Miller couldn't make this happen on his own. Trump can.
Well, just in closing, do you expect this issue to come up on the debate tonight amongst 10 of the Democratic candidates? I mean, I'm not sure that the Democrats really have a program or a project or a narrative on immigration. If they did, I think they'd be in better shape, but maybe something will come out tonight. What do you think?
Well, most of the candidates have come out and presented positions which are different than Trump, and to a greater or lesser degree, they've been forceful about what they would do about the border situation. I know Julian Castro has been very articulate about this. So I think that it will come up because the photo is pretty viral and it is so it's so strong. So yes, I do think this may come up today, and I'll be I'll be curious to hear how people talk about it.
Well, Diane Winston, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. It's always a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Diane Winston, who holds the Knight Chair in Media and Religion at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, and she's the former publisher of Religion Dispatches. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing the contrast between how the media piled on when a state legislator accused Joe Biden of touching her shoulders and kissing the back of her head, and accusations of rape by Trump's former wife, Ivana, which are now buttressed by a veteran journalist, E. Jean Carroll.
I'm just a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world below. There is no sickness, no toil nor danger in that bright land to which I go.
Legitimate sexual prey, sex with better judicial systems.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Amanda Marcotte, who is a feminist author, blogger, and a politics writer for Salon. She's the author of Troll Nation, How the Right Wing Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters Set on Rat-Effing Liberals, America, and the Truth Itself. And her latest articles at Salon are Trump's fans think he's a macho he-man, he's really a moral weakling who preys on women and kids, and Trump accused of rape, major media yawns. Why was E. Jean Carroll's story not front page news? Welcome to Background Briefing, Amanda Marcotte.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you, Amanda. And I would ask that question rhetorically. Why was E. Jean Carroll's story not front page news? I mean, in the time that this story broke, the New York Times had a big front page story on Bernie Sanders' wife's financial controversies. And if you go back a little bit, when Joe Biden was accused by a state representative in Nevada of being too sort of friendly and touchy-feely, that got enormous amounts of attention. So why? I mean, a rape accusation is pretty shocking in itself. But when the president of the United States is accused of rape, that's big news.
Yeah, it should be. But I wrote in the article that my suspicion was that it didn't feel like big news because she's one of two dozen women that has accused him of sexual misconduct. I think a lot of people already believed that Donald Trump was capable of rape. He probably had committed rape, and they had already made up their mind about how to feel about that. And I think that there was a sense in the media that this wasn't going to move the needle in any direction, that Donald Trump supporters would support him no matter what, that his opponents already think the worst of him. So they just didn't give it the coverage that it deserved because they thought, well, if it's not going to change anything, why does it matter? And after I published the piece, sure enough, a couple of reporters, Maggie Haberman of the New York Times, Kevin Drum of Mother Jones, confirmed that this is exactly what they thought, that it hardly seemed like spending time on the story that wouldn't, quote unquote, change anything.
But that's not the role of journalists, is it? To change the world? It's to report the facts.
Exactly. I mean, I feel like the problem with that mentality is that it's assuming that the only metric that matters is what people who voted for Trump think. And if they could possibly change their mind. And I understand that voting for Donald Trump is such a bizarre and repulsive behavior that it becomes very central to the way that people think of politics to ask why did you vote for Donald Trump? And is there any way, like, are you ignorant? Are you stupid? Are you crazy? Are you a bigot? Why? And is there anything that could ever make you be the kind of person that wouldn't do something so bad? I understand why that is such a central question in politics right now, but it's not the only question in politics. I mean, there are so many other relevant metrics and questions out there that need to be answered. And as I point out in my piece, the Women's March, was this shockingly huge protest movement, the biggest in American history, and it was a direct result of people being angry very specifically about Donald Trump's history of sexual assault. And to shrug as if the people that turned out for the biggest protest in American history don't matter, as if their opinions don't matter, as if they wouldn't be interested in this news, is shocking to me. And I think when I put that criticism out there, I feel like it actually thankfully got a lot of traction, and it forced a response from the New York Times as well as some other places.
Well, but then the question arises, Amanda Marcotte, what happened to those millions of women across the country and around the world who showed up the day after his inauguration in such extraordinary numbers with such spontaneous energy? Has that energy gone away? Have they fallen victim to the same yawn that you're hearing from the mainstream press?
No, absolutely not. I mean, they were the people that caused the Democrats to take the House in a landslide in 2018. It was the women. I know for a fact that it was. Everybody who was on the ground as a reporter and talked to organizers who were actually getting out the vote, who were doing the organizing, who were doing the fundraising, who were knocking on doors, it was the same women who turned out for the Women's March. And on election night in November, I went out to a watch party with a group of organizers from Indivisible, and they were all women. And I think that women right now being angry and fed up with male violence, with sexism, with misogyny, and the fact that the president of the United States is an emblem of that is probably the biggest story in American politics right now. And by ignoring this incredibly important piece of that, where this writer who'd bottled the secret up for decades kind of came out and spoke about it, it's baffling to me. It's ignoring the biggest story in American politics today.
Right. And she was writing a book, wasn't specifically about this incident. This is a part of the book. She was a longtime advice columnist with Elle magazine, I think. So that wasn't necessarily the reason she wrote the book, was it? It was in the book, and it's explosive enough. And again, both you and I are mystified as to why it hasn't gotten more attention, because it's such a serious thing in any case with anybody, but let alone the President of the United States. And again, I'm speaking with Amanda Marcotte, who's a feminist author, blogger, and a politics writer at For Salon. She's the author of Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters Set on Rat-Effing Liberals, America and the Truth Itself. And her latest articles at Salon are Trump's Fans Think He's a Macho He-Man, He's Really a Moral Weakling Who Preys on Women and Kids, and Trump Accused of Rape, Major Media Yawns, Why Was E. Jean Carroll's Story Not Front Page News? And in your article, of course, you point out that Trump was accused of rape by his first wife, Ivana. In a deposition, she testified that he'd raped her, and later she tried to retract the word rape, but not retract the details in the deposition. So that's pretty much on the record. Of course, her children are all coming to Trump's defense at the moment, although for the longest time, the boys were estranged from their father. So what do you think happened there within the family? It's since the family is a money-making operation. Is that what changed everybody's attitudes to their father?
I don't know what goes on in other people's families. I think that it is hard to deny, though, that Trump's sons are mediocre men who don't have a lot of pathways to being rich and famous that don't go straight through their father. I think, unfortunately, it's pretty easy to imagine that it became easier to forgive him and to even pretend that he didn't treat their mother the way that he did, because the continuing to not be his son, to refuse to speak to him, means shutting yourself off from a lot of economic opportunities that would be otherwise available to you.
Well, the other thing though that's pretty glaring and unequivocal, since we're speculating a little about a family matter, Trump's initial response was, when he was asked about these allegations that he raped Jean Carroll, he said, number one, she's not my type. Now, boy, I think that says it all, doesn't it? Isn't that adding insult to injury?
Yeah, I mean, the implication there is that if she was, he would have raped her, right? And I mean, I think that kind of gets at the heart. First of all, insulting a woman's looks when she comes out about sexual assault is pretty much standard. I tweeted that, I'm a survivor myself. I've written about it publicly. I've gotten the same response from men. You're too ugly to rape. I've been told this so many times I can't even tell you. And it's not just me. I don't think I'm ugly. Every woman I know who's told her story publicly about being sexually assaulted, was told she's too ugly to rape. That's just something men say to humiliate and degrade women. It's motivated in the same way that rape is. And so, you know, that Trump's instinct in this was to say something cruel and degrading and try to, like, put her in her place, suggests that he's of the mentality that commits sexual violence, you know, that and the fact that he's confessed on tape to doing so. And, you know, I think that he was signaling to his followers that, you know, this kind of behavior is not only okay, but perhaps laudable, that it makes you a big manly man. And unfortunately, I think a lot of his followers think that. They either think it's okay that women are making mountains out of molehills, or they think that it's admirable and that it makes you some big tough guy to pick on women. And I find that to be just unbelievable to me, because, you know, Trump is a big man. He's like 6'3 or something. And I have to say, like, why don't you big tough guys pick on someone your own size, you know?
Well, that's one of the things that Jean Carroll says about the rape itself, that he was big and overpowering, and she couldn't believe what was happening. And I guess it's exactly his mentality, as he expressed in that Access Hollywood tape, is when you're a star, they let you do it. So, you know, she didn't let him do it, although he did it. That's his mentality. What I find extraordinary, though, is we're talking about the lack of coverage and, by extension, outrage in the press. What about the Republican Party? Has the Republican Party, the GOP, become the grab our pussy party?
Yeah, I mean, what else is there to say about this? I mean, I recognize that the official line of Republicans is that these are all false accusations, that somehow just dozens upon dozens of women are just lying all the time for no reason. I know they said that about Brett Kavanaugh, who was accused by two separate women, neither of whom had any reason to lie, and one of whom was forced out of her home with her family because of all the threats. And I know that that's the official line, but I have to believe at a certain point that they can't really think that that's true. And that's just what they're saying to cover up for what I think is a darker, unfortunate trend, which is they just don't care.
But women care. So how is this going to translate politically?
Well, I know that the number of women, the percentage of the vote, of women's vote in 2018 was, for the Democrats, was higher than it was in 2016. I think it was a 3 percentage point shift. I think that this is going to continue to be true. I think that you're seeing some women, especially, there are some women that switched their votes from Republican to Democrat. I think that has happened. But more to the point, I think there were a lot of women, and the Women's March was a really good example of this, that were not politically active, that have been made politically active by this. They're angry. And it hits close to home in a way I think a lot of other politics don't. I think the Me Too movement, you know, went on and on. It's still going on, but it was, you know, in the headlines every day for months, because women just have decades. Most women have decades of anger built up over this stuff in them, and it's coming out now, and that stuff doesn't just go away overnight. I don't think that's going away anytime soon, and I wouldn't be surprised if more stories come out that keep this anger going. And if the Democrats were smart, they would have hearings where the women that have accused Trump could tell their story into the congressional record, and also, you know, live on television.
Well, do you think there'll be something along those lines tonight in the first Democratic debate? I mean, obviously, this photograph of the young Salvadoran father and his 2-year-old dead daughter face down in the Rio Grande River is having a powerful effect around the world. John Meacham, the historian, wrote a book recently, Invoking the Better Angels. Do you think what's been revealed that's going on the border with the cruel and inhumane treatment of children, who are the invocation in the Bible is to help the stranger, the parable of the Good Samaritan, seems to be lost on a lot of people on the religious right. But do you think that that picture, for example, that's shocked so many people, and the reports on what's happening, is there a possibility that our better angels will be aroused?
Oh, man, I hope so. I mean, I think it's hard to argue with the horror of that photograph. I mean, the flat-out truth of the matter is that the Republicans just don't have an answer for the suffering that's being inflicted on little children, both in these detention centers and because of the Remain in Mexico policy that's forcing families to take risks like that family did that resulted in that father and his daughter dying. I think that there's no muddying the waters, there's no grayness, there's nothing you can say that's going to make that okay or make somebody feel okay about supporting that. I hope that cuts through a lot of the nonsense and BS that's kind of in our politics right now, a lot of it driven by Trump, who thinks this is a reality TV show. But I've also, unfortunately, lost a lot of hope that there are issues that kind of rise above that kind of nonsense right now.
Well, I hope we're not all just being numbed to this new normal, or this horrible new normal, with this incredibly incompetent, ignorant, reckless, dangerous person who has no morality, no compassion, no heart. It should be so obvious to everybody that he's an embarrassment to this country and a danger to the world. But, you know, just saying it doesn't move the needle. And it certainly doesn't make me feel good. I just feel more frustrated. I can't believe that this is the person that represents us to the world, the very world that is shocked by this picture that is arousing so much indignation around the world. Well, we can end on a speech, I guess. I'm sorry about that.
No, it's okay. I mean, I think you're exactly right. Every word, man.
Okay. Well, good to talk to you, Amanda.
Nice to talk to you. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Amanda Marcotte, who's a feminist author, blogger, and a politics writer for Salon. She's the author of Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters Set on Rat-Effing Liberals, America and Truth Itself. And her latest articles at Salon are Trump's Fans Think He's a Macho He-Man, He's Really a Moral Weakling Who Preys on Women and Kids, and Trump Accused of Rape, Major Media Yawns, Why Was E. Jean Carroll's Story Not Front Page News? We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing tonight's first Democratic presidential debate and whether the field of 20 can be winnowed to the point where there'll be an opportunity for substantive debates between fewer candidates instead of a five-minute shot at getting recognized. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Alan Schroeder, who's a professor emeritus in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University in Boston. He's the author of several books, including Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk TV, and Celebrity in Chief, How Show Business Took Over the White House. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Schroeder.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Well, thanks for joining us, Alan. And tonight, of course, just as we get off the air with this program, live at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern, the first of the two Democratic debates will take place. The candidates will be standing in a tight semicircle on the stage at the Adrian Asch Center for the Performing Arts in Miami. From left to right, we'll have Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York, Congressman Tim Ryan of Ohio, Julian Castro, former Housing Secretary, Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, Senator Warren, Congressman O'Rourke, former Congressman, I guess, Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, Representative Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii, Governor Jay Inslee of Washington, and former Congressman from Maryland, John Delaney. So first off, Alan, there were 10 candidates in the Republican debate that Donald Trump, being the reality TV star, managed to knock everybody else off the island. Are there going to be a few people knocked off the island tonight, do you think?
I think it's likely, and not so much because there will be a Trump-like figure to do that, but more because of the way the rules are set up for the debates going forward, that it looks like the way this is going to work is each of the upcoming 12 debates after or 11 after tonight and tomorrow, they will raise the threshold for inclusion. So I think it's going to get harder and harder, which makes the spotlight for these especially lesser figures especially important in the debates this week. That's their only hope of going forward.
Well, that may not necessarily be a good thing, though, don't you think, Alan? Maybe they'll be sort of too strident or too anxious. How does that translate? In other words, how do you get noticed in a field of 10?
It's so difficult. And, you know, apart from the example of Trump, who is almost a sort of singular figure, and I don't think can be emulated exactly, there's no magic formula. If there were, you know, everybody would be using it. But I do think that a lot will depend on on the format, on the moderators, on how willing they are to give everyone a chance. One of the things with the 2016 Republican debates was that the moderators focused a lot of the attention on Trump. It wasn't just that Trump himself was so outrageous. So I think one of the interesting things here will be the extent to which the moderators include everyone or give everyone an equal shot, even those who at this point are polling very, very low.
But Alan Schroeder, as much as we have a crowded field on stage, we also have a crowded bunch of moderators. Five moderators seem like an awful lot to me.
I think it's too many moderators, and I think it signals a problem with what the primary debates have become, starting with the previous cycle and continuing now, which is that they're big shows for the cable news networks. They're moneymakers. They sell advertising. They expect big ratings, and the networks want to showcase their talent. So the networks are putting forward all these moderators that, in my opinion, are going to be superfluous when you already have just this huge number of people on the stage. So I think here's a great example of kind of the problem with what primary debates have become, is there's so much about ratings and attracting advertising dollars that I think the basic exercise itself gets changed in a way that isn't great for voter education.
And again, I'm speaking with Alan Schroeder, who's Professor Emeritus in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University in Boston. He's the author of several books, including Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk TV, and Celebrity in Chief, How Show Business Took Over the White House. So in terms of show business, and of course, I recall the famous adage of Clinton's guy, James Carville, that politics is show business for ugly people. But you have to admit that Ronald Reagan was successful, and he was a former actor. Bill Clinton was successful. He was very telegenic. Barack Obama was incredibly successful. He was very telegenic. Who would you think are the most telegenic, given that, you know, if you go back to the first debate with Nixon and Jack Kennedy, Kennedy supposedly won because he was a fresh face and Nixon had a 5 o'clock shadow.
Right. Well, I've been impressed with a number of different candidates as far as their performing skills go. I've been watching some of these one-on-one town hall interviews, and although that's a different thing than the debate, it gives you some idea of how they come across on TV. So in the first group, for instance, I think that Beto O'Rourke does very well on television. I think that Cory Booker comes off extremely well. Elizabeth Warren, I've been watching for a long time, and she's, I think, coming into her own as a public performer. And so I think those are some that the spotlight will be on, you know, in the first group. And then in the second group, you know, obviously you have Joe Biden, who's spent half of his life in front of the camera, it seems like. You have Kamala Harris, who I think has been quite good in some of her interviews. So I do think there's a lot of talent in the group. Now, whether any of those, you know, break through or not remains to be seen.
So you mentioned the formula that winnows out the field as they go ahead with these series of debates. I'm not up on it, as you are, Alan, but so some of the people already on stage tonight, I wonder why they're there. Mayor Bill Blasio, of course, is incredibly unpopular in New York, and why he's running, God only knows. Tim Ryan, Ohio, well, you know, I don't know about him. I mean, this is just my opinion, since... And John Delaney, another guy, former congressman. So those, I would think, would be hopefully quickly winnowed, because you really want to get to the more credible people, more interesting ones, not that other people may have different opinions. And then on Thursday night, one can hope that they winnow out Marianne Williamson, John Hickenlooper, Andrew Yang, Eric Swalwell. What are the chances of that? Well, tell us about the formula, because some of them who I think should be winnowed, like Marianne Williamson, is, you know, sort of a self-help guru and who's obviously got a following. That's how she's got on the stage. She may do well because she's obviously skilled at, you know, staging moments of sort of manufactured profundity. So how would you make the distinction between people who probably shouldn't be on the stage but might perform well, as opposed to those who shouldn't be on the stage and may not perform well?
Yeah, no, I think it's a fair question. And I think asking that question of why is this person up there, what is this person's true motivation, I think that's perfectly legitimate. Because clearly some of these people are either doing this for career purposes, not necessarily in terms of a presidential career, but just to, you know, to bolster their own standing. So you have that. And then you, some of the politicians that are way back in the pack, it's probably that they're laying the groundwork for their political futures in building their name recognition early on. I think when the Democratic National Committee set the standards for inclusion, it was many months ago, and they did not really anticipate that the field would be as booming and full as it has become. So what they're doing going forward is, it's a question of poll standings, a combination of where are people in the poll standings, and then how many donors do they have, you know, can they document from a lot of different parts of the country. So I think the DNC will just keep making it harder and harder on that basis, poll standings and how many donors. And then another metric they're using is how many paid staff members do you have in you know, the various locations around the country. So I think the DNC is aware of this problem. I think they got kind of caught a little off guard here this first time around, just by the sheer surprise of how many people are in this thing. But I agree with you. I think one of the purposes of these debates going forward is to winnow the field and to begin to figure out who's really serious here. And that's been true, you know, in every electoral cycle. You often have a large field, not this large, but you often have multiple candidates.
Well, I think Donald Trump clearly lowered the bar in that regard, because it was certainly made clear by his lawyer, Michael Cohen, in the congressional hearings, where he said that throughout the campaign, Trump would be talking to him and his inner circle, saying, I can't believe how great this campaign is going to be for the Trump Organization brand. He was running as a lark to improve his brand. Had he not won the presidency, his company would be incredibly successful, I think, now. Although, obviously, he's making lots of deals on the side for after he gets out. I'm sure the Saudis and the Emiratis are going to be funding him and Kushner's real estate companies. But would you agree that the fact that the guy that's in the White House now sort of ran, at least we're led to believe he ran as a branding exercise and he wasn't serious, and perhaps the gods in their irony made him victorious?
Yeah, I do agree with that. I don't think he went into it thinking there was any plausible way that he would emerge as the winner at the end of the thing. And it does show you kind of almost the danger of debates in a way, or the danger of any kind of live television exercise that carries this kind of importance. And that is that, you know, it can be subverted. And Trump was so good at sort of winning the spectacle of each of those events that, you know, it just started to snowball. And by the time I think the other candidates on the stage with him and the RNC figured out what was going on, you know, it was too late. There was no turning back. So some of what you're seeing in this 2020 cycle with the Democrats is in reaction to that. I think the Democratic National Committee is determined not to make that same mistake by instituting these sort of guardrails on inclusion.
So how much do you think, Alan Schroeder, the news events, there have been some pretty intense news events just in the last 24 hours or 48 hours, the revelations that migrant children were being held at the border in inhumane conditions, the appalling photograph of the young Salvadoran father face down in the Rio Grande with his dead two-year-old daughter, just heart-wrenching images. Do you think they're going to? And of course, the Supreme Court is expected to come out with findings at any moment that could also enter their way into the debate. How much do you think it'll be prepared statements vis-a-vis feeling obliged to talk about the news of the moment?
I do think that there's a tendency in these debates, especially because you have journalists moderating and asking the questions, to focus on the headlines of the day. And that's okay. You know, there's a lot that you can glean from the different candidates as far as their approach to things by looking at what's happening right at this moment. But by the same token, I hope that they talk about things that are ongoing problems, climate change, for instance, that don't provoke daily headlines, because there's a tendency, I think, on some of this big picture stuff for the moderators just to not ask anything at all about that. So it's a combination of responding to what's going on in the headlines right now and trying to get at broader policy issues. But let's be honest, the response times here are, I think each candidate has a minute to answer and maybe 30 seconds for rebuttals or summaries or you know, second chances to add to their answers. It's no time at all. My guess is probably we'll hear more in the way of kind of introductions and biographical details and more personal statements from the candidates as opposed to any kind of you know, real policy discussions, because there simply isn't time for that, even, you know, with 2 hours in this format.
Well, you're almost describing a Miss America contest, aren't you?
Kind of. Yeah, they won't be in bathing suits and tiaras, but short of that, yeah, right. There are some similarities here.
And what is your opinion on world peace?
Exactly. In 30 seconds. Please.
Right.
Yes.
So I guess with a crowded field of 10 on stage and a crowded bunch of moderators, five, that's one moderator for each two candidates, you're already coming into it in a sense. And you just pointed out how little time they'll all have, and there'll be enormous pressure on all of them to get noticed. So that is, I think, a distortion, isn't it? I mean, this is not going to give us a real picture of who these people are and what kind of leaders they would make.
No, it won't in and of itself. Now, I should say that although there are five moderators, they won't all be on the stage at the same time. I think it's the first hour is a single moderator, Lester Holt, and then two more join, and then two more different ones join on the Thursday night debates. So you you have some a little more time than it might seem when you say five moderators, but nonetheless, it's all we're going to get is a little sample of each of these candidates, which means, and I think this is an important point, is that it's incumbent on us as voters to do some homework on our own. We can't just sit there and passively expect to learn everything we need to know from a two-hour TV show. We need to follow up and go into the, onto the websites and dig through the articles and do some additional reading to find out, you know, who these people really are, because unfortunately this format does not give you much depth on any of them.
And when do you think they'll have a format, just in closing, when do you think they'll have a format where you will get some sense of the depth and vision of these candidates?
Well, the best the debates I've ever seen are the ones in France, where basically what happens is the two candidates sit down. They do have moderators, but the moderators don't do much more than set the thing up, and the two candidates just go at it with each other, very few interruptions. Very few interventions by the moderators, and that's a real interesting process. You really see how minds work and you know, who can kind of come through with an articulate response and who can't. But, of course, that's just two people, and I think as long as you have these crowded fields in the primaries, it's going to be very difficult to devise a format that really gets under the surface.
Well, Alan Schroeder, I thank you very much for joining us here today. We're about to go into the debates themselves, and I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Alan Schroeder, who's Professor Emeritus in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University in Boston. He's the author of several books, including Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk TV, and Celebrity in Chief, How Show Business Took Over the White House. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.